From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Elise Hugh. It's Here and Now. Three catastrophic wildfires continue to burn in California, forcing hundreds of thousands of people to flee their homes. The Camp Fire north of Sacramento has killed at least 29 people, and more than 100 are still missing. Meanwhile, in Southern California, the Woolsey and Hill fires have burned more than 96,000 acres from Malibu to the city of Thousand Oaks, which is still reeling from a mass shooting last week. NPR's Nathan Rott is in Thousand Oaks, and he joins us now. Nate, what's the footprint of these fires? Are the firefighters getting them under control, or are they still spreading?
I don't know if you can hear right now my notebooks kind of flinging around here. It's very windy this morning down here in Thousand Oaks, where I am right now. Yesterday, the wind had lit up some, which had given the firefighters a chance to make some ground up and try to get some containment lines around these fires. But the concern is these winds. There's a red flag warning in effect all day today into tomorrow for Southern California. There's a red flag warning up in Northern California where the campfire is burning. I talked to a person up there earlier this morning who said that they had a really rough run of it yesterday because of that wind. They had spot fires.
You can hear that wind,
right? Yeah. So obviously they're making some ground up, but this wind can undo that in a hurry.
We're also reading reports of people fleeing their homes only to wind up stuck in traffic. The L.A. County Sheriff's Department says that two bodies were found inside a stopped vehicle in Malibu. So how are authorities helping get people to safety given the congestion?
Well, they definitely just they keep declaring evacuation orders for different communities as they come under threat. And they're telling people, look, you got to go. As is always the case with any natural disaster, there's a lot of people who just don't want to leave their homes, and that obviously can complicate things. I think some of the fatalities that occurred in vehicles, that was just because of the speed at which these fires burnt. When they started going, they had these 40 to 50 mile per hour winds behind them, which, you know, moves a fire just about as fast as you can move your car.
That community, Nate, Ventura County, north of L.A., is obviously still reeling from last week's mass shooting in Thousand Oaks when a man opened fire at a bar, killing 12 people before he took his own life. The very next day, people across the county were evacuating from the wildfires. So how is that community coping?
You know, I've talked to some people that have been evacuated. At this hotel I was at last night, there were a lot of people that have left their homes. I think a lot of people are just still trying to get their head around it. Yeah. You know, it's been in almost a reactionary mode where it was one thing happens and then another. And I don't think a whole lot of people have had a chance to sit down and really let any of it sink in. Hmm. We talked to the mayor last night of Thousand Oaks. He said, look, it's a resilient town. People here are tough, but it's going to be hard when things settle down and they have a chance to reflect on everything that's happened over the last week.
Now, let's talk about leadership. California Governor Jerry Brown is seeking a major disaster declaration from the White House. He laid some of the blame for the destruction on people who deny the threat of climate change. Let's listen to the governor of California.
Managing all the forests in every way we can does not stop climate change. And those who deny that are definitely contributing to the tragedies that we're now witnessing and will continue to witness in the coming years.
That statement from Governor Brown yesterday comes after a tweet by President Donald Trump on Saturday in which Trump blamed the fires on, quote, gross mismanagement of the forests. He changed his tone in a later tweet, but how is Trump's response going over in California?
Like a lead balloon. You know, Jerry Brown didn't say Trump's name there in that statement, but he definitely alluded to the president's tweets a couple of times in his speech. It's a complicated thing. I mean, Jerry Brown, what he's saying is absolutely true. Climate change is a huge factor in these fires that we're now seeing become pretty regular in lots of the West. President Trump continues to kind of harp on the need to change the way we manage our forests. Critics argue that he's just arguing for more logging or basically placating to some of the constituents that he has in California's Central Valley where water is a big issue. The reality is fire ecologists would say, yeah, look, we need to probably look at forest management a little different given the reality in which we're living in right now. But logging and thinning is not the solution in every place. It certainly wouldn't have done anything to affect the fire down here in Southern California, where it was mostly burning in an urban area.
That's NPR's Nathan Rott, who is covering the fires for us. Nate, thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Elise.
Recounts in the governor's and Senate races in Florida's Broward and Palm Beach counties are in turmoil today. Let's go to Broward and the Senate race. Last night, the Republican, Governor Rick Scott, filed his second lawsuit since last week, accusing Palm Beach and Broward County election supervisors, Democrats, of fraud. He's also called for impounding voting machines. Scott spoke to Fox and Friends this morning.
We know that, you know, they didn't let in party officials to observe. We know that they didn't, there was no transparency. They were supposed to tell us where all this was coming from, when, how many ballots, all these things. We know mysteriously 93,000 new ballots showed up after Election Day.
And Katie Slutowski is Broward County reporter for NPR member station WLRN. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Robin.
Look, start there. Broward County Supervisor Brenda Snipes has had problems before. A judge ruled that in a 2016 congressional race, she got rid of some ballots, threw them out before she was supposed to, earlier than she should have. But what are officials saying about the governor's claims now that party officials weren't allowed to observe, that 93,000 ballots mysteriously showed up? What's the response?
So I was actually in the supervisor of elections office canvassing board meeting room when attorneys asked to be let in from different campaigns to observe the recount process. And they were let in. Representatives from eight campaigns and parties were let in to watch exactly what was happening. I think the confusion comes from when they asked to go inside. At first, the first response from Broward was, well, you can watch through a window. And that didn't go over well. So then they were let inside. But they were allowed to watch what's going on.
And what about 93,000 ballots just showing up?
Yes. So that's also not what, not what I've seen at all. We know that Broward has been counting votes. They counted votes after Tuesday all the way through Saturday afternoon. But they met state deadline, and the votes that they were counting were vote by mail, provisional, and absentee ballots that had already been received. So there wasn't this mysterious finding bags or boxes of ballots. And the state's Florida Department of Law Enforcement actually said, you know, they don't see evidence of fraud. So it's really trying to put to bed this social media rumor mill that's gone a little wild.
Well, but there have been problems. There were technical glitches that delayed the start of the recount in Broward this weekend. Last week, officials there failed to upload all the in-person early votes and absentee ballots by the time the polls closed on Election Day. Snipes, who's a registered Democrat, admits to mixing 22 ballots that had been rejected in with about 205 legal ones. So little, you know, there have been these problems. But she pushed back when asked by reporters why the vote counting was taking longer than other counties. And, you know, maybe she wasn't taking it seriously.
I've been doing this now since October 22nd.
But if it's a serious
issue with you.
We ran
22 sites. We ran 14 days. We ran 12 hours. We had a big vote by mail. So don't try to turn it around to make it seem like I'm making comedy out of this.
Katie, as we've pointed out, Snipes has been very criticized before, but she's being defensive and holding her own. You know, what is the thinking here? Is the problem the officials, or is it, just something about the county, or is it the fact that we expected things to be done on election eve and across the country they weren't?
I think it's a little bit of all of that. I think because Broward is the second most populous county in Florida, things take longer here anyway. There are a lot of ballots, and that's been Snipes' main defense. We also had a really long ballot, 5 or 6 pages, depending on where you live in this county. And so I think one of the big accusations is, oh, you know, you only want things done fast and instantaneous when the races are close. The idea is that it usually takes this long, but it just doesn't affect the outcome.
Yeah. You mentioned the ballot, the very lengthy ballot. Democrats aren't happy with the ballot in Broward County because the Senate race was tucked low down on the page underneath voting instructions. They think people missed it. But the parties get to sign off on these ballots. So, you know, they saw it before. And, you know, in talking about the delay in Palm Beach County, you're there in Broward, but in Palm Beach County, they only have 8 machines to recount hundreds of thousands of votes. So this could take a while.
This could absolutely take a while. I talked to a couple of political professors, and the same sentiment I keep hearing is this is not going to be done before Thanksgiving. We're not going to have clear outcome winners for really until much later in November.
Wow. Okay. And yet, yep. And yet, is the thinking still that It will be a long shot for the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, Andrew Gillum, that Ron DeSantis, the Republican, will probably win the governor's seat. And it's still a toss-up for Scott and Nelson.
That is the thinking right now. Obviously, it depends on what the machine recount says. And that actually is supposed to start in Broward County later today. The idea is, you know, the Senate race is still too close. It could go to a hand recount after this machine recount. And that gap is much more narrow.
Boy. Katie Swietoski, Broward County reporter for WLRN, who will have her work cut out for her. For the next couple weeks. Katie, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Folks, I've just been down to Memphis down. That's where the people smile on you all the while.
When you hear this music, you may be thinking Louis Armstrong, but maybe you should also be thinking about the man who wrote this song. Legendary composer W.C. Handy, or William Christopher Handy, is recognized as one of the people who helped birth the blues. And this Wednesday, the New York Festival of Song, a celebration of song and songwriter, will honor Handy. This year's concert is titled W.C. Handy and the Birth of the Blues. Elliot Hurwit is a music historian and program consultant for the festival. Elliot, welcome.
Hi.
So get us started, because there are some people saying, oh, great, W.C. Handy, I'm very familiar. Others, not so much. Tell us more about him.
Well, Handy used to be one of the most famous people in the United States, but memories of cultural figures fade. He was born in Florence, Alabama in 1873, so during the post-Reconstruction era, and got a great primary school musical education, was trained in an old-fashioned singing style, the do-re-mi singing style, by a very good teacher.
What does that mean, do-re-mi?
Well, it means that instead of using fixed scales, C, D, E, F, G, you move the opening pitch around depending on what key or vocal range you're going to sing it in.
Yeah, we know it's do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, but what do you mean by...
You just did it.
Oh.
I can't do anything better than that.
Like in Sound of Music.
Exactly.
Okay, so that do, re, mi.
Yep.
But his family wanted him to be more what?
They wanted him to become either a lawyer, a teacher, or a preacher, like his father and grandfather. His grandfather was shot and wounded in a slave escape attempt around the time of the Civil War, and they did not desire for Handy to go into essentially traveling shows, which he ultimately did, traveling all around the country with Mehara's minstrels. And at about the time he quit doing that, blues was beginning to emerge in the Mississippi Delta primarily. We're now fast-forwarding to about 1905. And he would travel around the countryside with his bands and listen to people play folk music. In fact, his band members would ask him, why are you always standing on street corners listening to beggars? And he would have a pencil and a scrap of paper with him, and he would take down ideas. Some of this folk music he heard was what we now call as blues, and it became quite a popular thing, not just in the South initially, but then in New York and Chicago, all over the U.S., and then quickly in England, France, and all over the world.
A couple questions. When you say he was standing on street corners, at one point he was living on them. I mean, wasn't one of his bands shut down and he was somewhat homeless? I'm thinking that might have put him closer to this sound.
Well, it's quite possible. I mean, when he hit the skids in 1893, blues didn't exist yet. Handy took to the road with a vocal quartet in 1893, hoping to at least make a living in the Midwest, and they hit the skids in St. Louis, and Handy ended up alone, sleeping on cobblestones, and was found by a stable hand standing on a bridge, and the guy thought he was going to jump in and kill himself, and he got Handy a job mucking out stalls, and from there he was able to get three square meals a day and buy a decent suit of clothes and a musical instrument. He did this off and on from 1893 to 1896, and he was basically a hobo.
Yeah, which is why he could come up with songs like the Memphis Blues. Let's listen.
That's right.
Self-published in 1912, but here again is that 1954 version with Louis Armstrong and his All-Stars Band.
They got a trumpet man leading the band, and folks, he sure blows them horn. And when the clarinet seconds to the trombone's croon, it moans just like a sinner on revival day.
Now, this was also referred to as Mr. Crump. Why is that?
Well, the original version of this was a 1909 campaign song. Ed Crump was a successful businessman in Memphis who decided that the local government was corrupt and tied in with the gamblers and the saloon owners, and he ran a reform ticket on a three-way race and surprisingly beat the better-known guys. Mm-hmm. Andy had written Mr. Crump, and his band traveled around Memphis in a wagon, playing and singing the song, which actually disses Crump for saying, you know, we won't allow any barrel house women around here.
Well, the hits just started coming. This next one is called St. Louis Blues, written in 1914 and performed by Handy's Memphis Blues Band.
What Handy did with this that was so brilliant was he created a sort of three-part song structure. The second section is a tango, which was wildly popular at that time as a dance form. And then the third section is kind of a rapid tempo, rhythmic outro. It was kind of a brilliant idea to have three very strong themes used in a single song, and that minor key thing in the second strain. Nobody else used it until 1920, and there were hundreds of so-called blues written and published in that time period.
I want to listen now to Yellow Dog Blues. It was first called the Yellow Dog Rag. It's 1925, and it's Bessie Smith.
Ever since Miss Susie Johnson lost the jockey lead, there's been much excitement and motor beat. You can hear moaning, moaning night and morn. She's wondering where Easy Rider's gone.
What is W.C. Handy's status at this point?
In 1925, he was somebody who had written a string of hits, but was kind of slightly over the hill in terms of the pop culture, had slipped into something of a slump. Huh. Handy's own company had really gone down. He had become very sick, gone blind, and was really just barely holding on. And then people like Bessie Smith started to pick up his songs and record them. Huh. And it marked a return to popularity that increased throughout the 1920s with a lot of recordings and then just, you know, grew and grew and grew.
We want to listen to a song that was written in 1920 and it's become a jazz standard. This is Ant Hager's Children's Blues. He's referring to Hager from the Bible in the book of Genesis, Abraham's wife Sarah, unable to bear children, so she presented him with Hagar, her slave, and with Abraham, Hagar had Ishmael. Let's listen. Told us that this is Ann Hager as both symbolic mother of African Americans, embodiment of black womanhood. I mean, it's just reminding us that, you know, this man was becoming, as you said, a popular figure, a cultural figure. in a country that was still incredibly racist. Some of us, when we think of him, we think of the picture of him in his jaunty hat, I think it was, on, you know, on his music sheets. But how was he treated and viewed in this country?
His experience with racism in the South was bad, but not nearly as bad as some people. In Memphis, he was regarded as a good local band leader, and then when he put out Memphis Blues, which was named for his city, he began to become more accepted locally. People liked the advertising. Then in 1918, he moves to New York, and he can't even rent a desk, let alone an office, because the people there in Tin Pan Alley really don't understand quite what he's doing. The Aunt Hagar symbolism, you know, the idea of the kind of downtrodden or despised slave who becomes the vessel of the higher-ranking people's family and genetic line is kind of interesting, but the words are interesting for another reason. He didn't write them. They're often not sung. They're written by Lieutenant Tim Brim, who had been a black band leader with the U.S. forces in World War I in Europe. And Brim's words are a little arcane historically today because he refers to things having to do with our boys have just come home, meaning, you know, they want to hear some good jive music now and dance. So it's a very interesting piece.
Well, he couldn't get a desk in New York at one time, but now W.C. Handy is going to be celebrated in New York. Elliot Hurwit is the music historian and program consultant for the New York Festival of Song, the annual series of musical performances which spotlight the art of song and songwriter. And this year's concert, W.C. Handy and the Birth of the Blues, will link you up to everything you need to know at hereandnow.org. But Elliot, thank you so much for just reminding us of the wealth of music here. Thank you.
And thank you.
That means in Creole, sing 'em low.
It's here.
I like that pretty word, Chantilly-bye.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Leaders in France and England held services yesterday to mark the end of World War I and to remember those who were killed or wounded in the war. The war with Germany ended when the armistice was signed on November 11, 1918. From London, Here and Now's Alex Ashlock reports on this year's Remembrance Day.
This year's Remembrance Day had echoes of the first, held here in 1919, a year after the so-called War to End All Wars ended. A wreath was placed in honor of the Queen of England at the Cenotaph, the massive stone memorial near Parliament. Yesterday, in a gesture of reconciliation, the German president also placed a wreath. Then there were 2 minutes of silence, followed by the playing of The Last Post, the British version of Taps. Later, thousands of military veterans and ordinary citizens with family connections to World War I walked in a procession. The crowd, and there were thousands lining the streets, applauded as a military band played. Remembrance Day here is similar to Memorial Day in America. It carried added significance this year because it fell 100 years to the day after World War I had ended. Great Britain lost more than 700,000 troops in the war, and people from all over the world were in London to remember them. Marie-Christine's strengths came from Belgium, where some of the worst battles of the war were fought.
Because I believe that the British show every year lots and lots of respect for the soldiers, okay? So we thought, why with 100 years we go and can't feel the goosebumps?
David Farmer now lives in Tasmania, but he grew up in London. and he fought back tears as he recalled his grandfather, who fought in World War I.
Scotsman. He was a miner. Six children. Volunteered early on. Came back. Went back down the mines. Never spoke of it. After it was over, for him, it was over. That was it. Don't talk about it.
Like nearly everyone else, David Farmer was wearing an artificial red poppy pinned to his jacket.
My last one fell off, and all I've got is 20p now.
Well,
is that all right?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The poppy is a symbol of Remembrance Day, a tradition that springs from the John McCrae World War I poem that begins, "In Flanders fields, the poppies blow, between the crosses, row on row." Nearby, Jeanette Finn and her husband were handing people poppies in exchange for donations for charity.
We have no connection with the services, but we always felt it's one thing that we could do in memory of all those lost.
Big Ben is being renovated, but that work was paused on Remembrance Day. Its bell rang out, along with those across the city, just as they did on November 11, 1918. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock in London.
Question, do you think it's ever okay to spank your child? I know what the kids riding along in the car might be saying, but 20 years ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics, or AAP, said parents should be encouraged to not spank. Now they've come out with a stronger warning. Parents should never spank their children. They say a body of research shows that spanking has long-term negative consequences and not a lot of short-term except a negative impact on the relationship parents have with their kids. Dr. Robert Segi is a pediatrician at Tufts Medical Center in the Floating Hospital in Boston and one of the authors of that statement. So, Dr. Segi, don't use spanking as a parenting tool. Why? What are you finding?
Studies show that when children are spanked, they become more oppositional and more aggressive and act out in different ways. And sometimes this makes the parents spank them more, and one can get in a really vicious cycle where the children misbehave and the parents punish them more. In addition, there have been a number of studies that have looked at the effectiveness of corporal punishment, and it turns out that it's not effective in the medium or long term. So we have something that doesn't work and can hurt children.
Well, let's hear more about how it can hurt children. Obviously, it's painful. But you just said that children can have increased aggression, you know, down the road. Is it true? I think I'm reading that, in fact, the conclusion is that spanking alone is associated with outcomes similar to those of children who've been physically abused.
Yeah, there's one paper that puts that out, and I think that there's some truth to that. Because what we know is that what happens when a child is hit by their parents is really shame and humiliation, and it undermines that wonderful, loving bond between parents and children. And it's that psychological problem more than, you know, any physical issue that's the problem with spanking.
Well, talk about that. I mean, there's the pain, the physical pain. But talk about that. What is that? Pain of betrayal? Sudden lack of trust in this person that's supposed to be this loving person?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. That what happens is in your very first and most important loving relationship, someone inserts fear and violence. And from a child's point of view, the person they're supposed to love and trust might hit them and hurt them from time to time. So it makes them wary and cautious. And they also, because they love their parents, they learn that violence is okay, that it's okay to hit somebody else. And so that part of what happens with their behavior is actually that they're imitating their parents, or at least their perception of their parents.
Look, the pediatricians apparently already largely agree with this thinking. A survey showed that 74% didn't approve of spanking, 78% thought spanking never or seldom improved children's behavior. As you said, it isn't even effective. But what do you do with the remaining pediatricians and their families, the people they work with, who think this is a bunch of hooey. This is just soft thinking coming out of Boston, you know, and yeah. and that, you know, every now and then a child needs some corporal punishment.
You know, I that's a really good question, and that's one of the roles of the American Academy of Pediatrics in developing a policy statement. My co-author, Dr. Siegel from Boston University, and I spent literally years reviewing the literature, and then it was reviewed again by dozens of other pediatricians and by the board of the American Academy of Pediatrics. So pediatricians will read this in the journal of the AAP, and they'll understand that the scientific evidence is, at this point, extremely strong. And we found that most pediatricians will follow AAP policy or at least feel an obligation to tell the parents of families they care for that this is the official policy of the AAP.
Yeah. Look, it seems as if it's going down in popularity among surveys of parents as well over the years. But we're remembering back to when BostonGlobe.com reminds us that there were clinical psychologists and best-selling authors who talk about spanking. In 1970, there was one, Fitzhugh Dodson, who said it was his pow-wow approach. It's my pow, followed by his wow. And then he'd demonstrate how he'd hit a child's bottom. And he said at the time it was actually better, especially for single moms who have no other way to control their children. Look, that's kind of horrifying, but I'm also imagining that there are parents saying, I'm at wit's end, I have no other way.
Yeah. So two comments on that. One is there's so many things that people believed 50 years ago that we no longer believe. Mm-hmm. That's why people keep studying things and finding out more. So I think we're in a much better place than we were in 1970s. But one of the things that pediatricians can do is to help parents from getting to that last resort. Parents talk to us a lot about child behavior problems, and we can work with parents and do some mutual problem solving so parents never get to that level of frustration where they don't know what else to do.
Yeah. By the way, you have a website, and at the website healthychildren.org, there's tips for, you know, alternatives, you know, timeouts, you know, other consequences for behavior. But what should the parent do that just has that one moment? This isn't a regular thing. This isn't, you know, every Tuesday if they don't like Johnny's report card, you know, turn around and you get a spanking. This is maybe something that just happens because they lose it. What should you do if you have spanked your child and you regret it?
Well, you know, if you have spanked your child and you regret it, you can certainly apologize to the child, explain how you were feeling, and plan not to do that again. You know, all of us have moments when we feel ourselves getting angry and irrational and frustrated. And that's the time when you take a big breath, tell the child to, you know, go to their room, go to the corner, do something, get out of my sight, and then calm yourself down for a minute.
You know, but we talk about the emotional effect. There's the physical effect that it creates a child who's actually going to be more aggressive down the road. But is it true that it also affects a child's brain and way of thinking?
You know, in the 21st century, now that we have ways of looking inside a child's growing brain, using MRI scans and things like that, we now have a great appreciation of how a child's experience determines how their brain grows. And there was a couple of recent studies that showed that children whose parents relied on corporal punishment, their brains had a smaller part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex than other children who weren't spanked. And it turns out that this region is where some of the self-regulation that we all have to control our own behavior occurs. So studies are relatively small, but they're convincing because there are so many other studies that have shown changes in children's brain growth as a result of things like child abuse and other issues. Mm-hmm. So we find it extremely concerning that spanking a child may lead to permanent changes in their brain.
Yeah. But would you go as far as calling regular corporal punishment spanking, or a ruler that was known in the house as going to be the punishment, or a paddle? Would you go as far as saying right now that that is child abuse?
You know, I don't think so. I think that I would love to live in a world where that was the worst thing that happened to children.
Yeah.
But I think that what we would like to do is so many parents come to us for advice on how to help children, how to help them with children's problematic behavior. And we can offer them lots of good advice. and counsel them not to spank their children. For parents who need more help, most communities have family resource centers or parenting classes, and pediatricians know where those resources are. And we can really help parents do a much better job raising their kids, because what we know is deep down, almost all parents truly love their children and would do anything for them. And they come to us for advice based on the best knowledge we have now. And that's what this policy statement does, is it gives them access to the best information we have now. And we have lots of ways to help them solve the traditional problems of childhood.
It's not just don't do this, it's here's another choice. Dr. Robert Segi, pediatrician at Tufts Medical Center and the Floating Hospital in Boston, and one of the authors behind the new policy statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics, do not spank. Dr. Segi, thank you.
Thank you very much.
So that's research, but a new ABC News poll shows that people approve of spanking children in principle by a 2-to-1 margin and have said they did it, but they don't want anyone else to do it to their kids. 72% say they disapproved of spanking or corporal punishment in schools. And right now, corporal punishment is allowed in schools in 19 states. So weigh in. Do you spank? Were you spanked? Are you one of those who think this is a bunch of hooey? Or are you horrified that what you're hearing is the negative result? All thoughts welcome, hereandnow.org.
We're following recounts in Florida in the governor's race and the Senate contest after Republican Rick Scott watched his lead over incumbent Democratic Senator Bill Nelson shrink to just 12,000 votes. In Georgia's governor's race, Democrat Stacey Abrams is behind by tens of thousands of votes, but her campaign filed a federal lawsuit over the weekend to give officials more time to look at any votes that may have been rejected. And in Arizona, Democrat Kyrsten Sinema now has a lead of 30,000 votes, or around 1.5%, over Republican Martha McSally in the Senate contest there. Nearly a week now after Election Day, did Democrats do better in the midterms than we initially thought? Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us as he does each Monday from New York. Hey, Derek.
Hello.
The reporting after election night was somewhat of a mixed result, right? That Republicans made gains in the Senate and Democrats took back the House, but not by historic margins. With a week now of hindsight, has that thinking changed?
Yeah, I think it has changed quite a bit. There was this whole debate over whether or not Democrats succeeded in this blue wave.
Right.
And you'd think that a writer for The Atlantic would have a facility for nautical metaphors. But I myself have not been able to figure out exactly what a blue wave is. So let's just stick to the numbers.
Okay.
Democrats are now expected to add between 35 and 40 House seats. That's huge. That's the biggest Democratic gain in the House since the election of 1974, the Watergate election.
Wow.
And you could argue that it's even stronger than that, even stronger than it looks. Really healthy economies like the one we have today tend to protect the party in power. So when J.P. Morgan analysts adjusted these midterm elections for the economic circumstances, unemployment under 4%, et cetera, they concluded that this was the single most surprising loss for a party in power in the last 100 years. You add on top of that the fact that Democrats picked up seven governors. That's the biggest turnover in governor's mansions since the historic 1994 midterm where Republicans swept into power. You put it all together, it is a fairly strong, a very strong even, midterm election for the Democrats, much stronger than it seemed in the middle of Tuesday night.
Derek, how did these signals then get overlooked last week?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, first, I think it really was a long night. A lot of these returns weren't obvious to people until 10, 11 p.m. So it's as if we all sort of made up our mind at 8:30 that the House was sort of a toss-up, and we haven't adjusted that prior, but we should adjust it. The complicating issue here is the Senate. Democrats lost two, maybe three, maybe even more Senate seats, and That's pretty bizarre given their overall performance. And I think it just goes to show how strong the GOP still is in states like Florida and North Dakota and Indiana that have either a lot of white voters, a lot of older voters, or a lot of voters who have less than a college education. That seems to be the sort of demographic stronghold of the Republican Party right now. But the best joke that I heard about the election is that, at least for Democrats, it wasn't like Christmas. It was more like Hanukkah. You had to wait around a few days to see the full bearing of gifts.
All right. And looking ahead to 2020 for Democrats, there's already disagreement over whether to choose a more centrist candidate for president or a more progressive one, how aggressively to go after President Trump in these 2 years in the House. There's also a number of politically gerrymandered districts across the country that, as we know, favor Republicans. So what did we learn about those districts in the election and what that means for policy and political strategy in the coming years?
Right. So in most states, those districts are drawn up by state lawmakers and governors. Mm-hmm. So for Democrats, it's important that they had the biggest biggest governor's mansion turnover in the last 24 years. Colorado, Michigan, and Missouri also managed to pass measures that will theoretically reduce the amount of gerrymandering that's in their state. Then again, you know, gerrymandering, finding the right district that has the right sort of proportional representation of that city, that's difficult. So a lot of states don't ask one party or another party to do it. They ask a bipartisan or independent committee group to draw up districts that should relatively ensure fairness. And as of Sunday, a proposal in Utah said that it would do – I think that vote actually might be too close to call. But Utah was voting on that. Arizona and California and a couple other states have similar systems. So my hope is that nationally we move toward a system that takes the engineering of these districts out of the hands of partisan lawmakers, and we place it in the keep of independent groups that aren't going to give people sort of a lasso-y sense every single 10 years that the districts are going to look entirely different.
In the big picture, there was historically high turnout. Can you put that into context? Does turnout, big turnout numbers, does that tend to favor one party over the other?
In this case, it seems to have demonstrated – in this case, I think you can definitely say that it helped Democrats because the type of voter that tends not to show up in the midterms tends to be a minority voter or a young voter. But in many states, voting among young people was up by over 200%, and voters under the age of 40 – broke for Democrats by 60%, 60% to 40%. So, yes, in this election specifically, you saw that this enormous, let's call it a wave, of young voters did help to push Democrats over the top.
Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks for joining us, Derek.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Elise Hugh.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.